This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
When Mitt Romney was caught on hidden camera talking about 47% of America's not paying income tax and seeing themselves as victims, he set off a firestorm of controversy. But one place that controversy's not yet taken us, consideration of tax fairness. How much do you pay in taxes? What do you get for what you pay? How fair is your burden compared to your neighbor? And speaking of comparison, how do taxes in the U.S. rank against other parts of the world? Raquel Alexander and Joe Thorndike have been studying such questions for years. They've not only uncovered surprising answers, they seem to have discovered how to make talk about tax policy, well, fun. Don't believe it? Try them out for even just a few minutes and see if you don't understand more about taxes than you ever thought possible as we delve into tax fact surprises right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. So, what would make taxes more fair? We have two longtime policy researchers with us who have several ideas in response to that question, but we'd like to hear your ideas as well. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. Do you pay too much in taxes? Does someone else pay too little? How would you change things? 888-967-2825. Historian Joe Thorndike is author of a number of books on tax policy, his newest due out in just a few weeks. Joe, great to see you back in the Insight Studios.
Well, it was great to be here. Thank you.
And with us for the first time, a woman who used to work as a tax consultant for one of the world's largest professional service firms, but today teaches about tax policy as a professor at Washington and Lee University, Raquel Alexander. Thank you for making time for us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So after all your years of research, both of you, I'm curious, what is it that you understand about taxes that you might suspect most of the rest of us don't yet know?
Well, right now we're having a lot of discussion about corporations and how to make us more competitive around the world. And I think that people would be surprised to learn that overall, the U.S. rates are some of the lowest in the world. So when we look at kind of rankings of where we are compared to our peer nations and even other developing nations, out of 34 nations, we're ranked number 31 in the lowest overall tax burden.
So there are only three other countries in the world that pay less in taxes.
Yeah, according to the OECD reports.
Mm-hmm. The OECD?
Right. It's
the Organization of...
For Economic Cooperation
and Development.
And the answer, you know, we're actually, at least according to the chart that I have here, we're third from the bottom. That puts two beneath us, which is Mexico and Chile as having lower tax burdens than us. But everyone else has a higher tax burden. Almost across the board. You know, we think of them as all European nations, and it's true that it's a lot of Northern European nations and, you know, the usual suspects of Sweden and Denmark and also France and Germany and everyone else. But it includes a lot of Asian countries, real competitors to us, you know, say Korea, who we think of as a country that we got to try to work hard to beat out in the competitive landscape. They have a higher tax burden than we do also.
How do they measure this, Joe? In what way are they ranking or determining which country pays the most in taxes, which pays the least, and how the U.S. ends up paying about the third least?
Well, generally speaking, these numbers are usually the ones they usually give you are taxes as a percentage of gross domestic product. So, you know, that allows you to compare a small country like Denmark to a big country like the U.S. and give you some sense of, you know, if everything that this country manages to put together in a year and produce, How much of that stuff is getting channeled through the tax system being used by government for anything else, you know, for education, for social welfare, for whatever.
And so the U.S., do I recall you telling me once, Joe, is about 24% of GDP?
It's about 24% of GDP. Now, at the top of the list is Denmark. They're channeling about 48%. Of their GDP through the tax system.
So I realize that it's difficult to make exact comparisons, but does that sort of mean that somebody in the U.S.
if they moved to Denmark and made about the same salary, they'd pay twice as much in tax?
It's more complicated than that, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. So there's a whole, you know, basket of goods and services that are taxed in these European nations under the value-added tax, which is kind of like equivalent of a national sales tax. We don't have a value-added tax or a VAT here. So we have the sales tax at the state level. And then also at the individual level, they have different deductions. So many countries don't allow for the mortgage deduction for purchasing the home. And then a lot of the countries that Joe has pointed out, they have much higher taxes for their social programs.
So their equivalent of a social security tax would be considerably higher.
It would. It would. And they provide more benefits as well.
When you talk about the fact that in the U.S., we don't have a national sales tax, and most other countries, am I correct? Most other countries in the world have this value-added tax that's sort of like a national sales tax?
Just us and Brazil, I think, at this point, are the only ones that don't have a VAT.
So when we're looking at this total amount funneled through GDP in terms of what a nation's tax burden is, or how much in taxes is part of the economy, does that include what Americans are paying in all those local and state sales taxes?
It does. It includes the consumption taxes, the state and local level.
So, Joe Thorndike, you've been writing about this for many, many years. Why do we in America think that our taxes are far, 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 far too high?
Because everybody thinks taxes are too high in every country, everywhere. It's not like if you went to any of these other countries, they'd be like, oh, no, our taxes are great. We love them. I mean, this is the thing that as a historian kind of drives me crazy, is that we have this notion of ourselves as a nation of tax haters, which is true as far as it goes. But every nation is a nation of tax haters. So, you know, that being said, I don't want to say that anti-tax sentiment isn't important in the U.S. and hasn't always been important, because there has been a powerful strain of tax resistance in American political culture for 200 years. But it's not like that really distinguishes us from other countries so much. I think that, you know, Americans don't like taxes just like other people. What really might distinguish us more is that we're not that wild about government in general. So other countries, I think, demand more of their government. They expect more of their government, and they're willing to pay more for it. But here we're a little bit more suspicious about government activity. That makes it a little harder to sell the taxes here.
So to you who are listening, when was the last time you said to yourself, gee, if only I paid more in taxes, the world would be a better place? Can't quite remember. Well, you still might have some ideas on how to improve tax policy. Our call-in number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Well, actually, in all numbers, it's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Our guests, tax policy researchers Raquel Alexander and Joe Thorndike. So let's talk about tax fairness. Are there issues to be made on, no matter how we compare to the rest of the world, what we get for what we pay in taxes in the U.S., or who pays how much and how fair it is or isn't?
Well, I think those, some of those are the most difficult conversations that we have. You know, tax policy is really a reflection of our values as society, coupled with really aggressive lobbying by some really wealthy individuals and entities. So when we look at taxes, you know, there's 70% of business income isn't taxed at all because we've allowed this tax treatment for flow-through entities like partnerships and S-corps and LLCs to escape taxation altogether. So when we have tax reform, unlike what people are saying, that this is going to be just like 1986, the time is right for this bipartisan. In 1986, it didn't raise revenue. It was really revenue neutral. And that was coupled with really high interest rates at the time that were driving people to kind of change how we taxed individuals and entities. We don't have those high interest rates now, and we're not seeing a bipartisan effort. And it's going to be really difficult to close some of these, you know, loopholes or special incentives in the tax code to have more fairness. We can all say, yes, let's lower the rate. But when we talk about expanding the base and having all entities be taxed at the same rate and not getting special deductions, there's a lot of differences. And I think there's this idea that, well, if Romney's elected, the business community will be happy. They'll get their tax deductions, the lower rate. The business community is divided. they have different lobbying coalitions. There's the rate coalition that wants the rate to go down, and there's another group that says, we're fine with the rate, basically. Just let us keep our deductions, please, because they've been really good about inserting their special provisions into the tax code.
What do you mean, Raquel Alexander, when you say have more fairness?
Have more fairness in the tax code. I do think that there's unfairness when we have this double taxation, when we have multiple layers of taxation on the same type of income. And I think that that is a goal to work towards reducing that double taxation. However, you know, whenever we close a window, the door opens somewhere else. The reason that we have this structure is to prevent people from avoiding taxation altogether. And so it's a difficult balance. And, you know, I wish that I had the answer to all of this. But I think it's a coupling of the consumption tax along with an income tax. And I think that's going to be our future.
You know, so much of the argument in this campaign, and it's reasonable, has been about the corporate tax and how it – and I think it's partly because – Democrats and Republicans are united in their claim that we need to reform the corporate income tax. And in particular, they're united that we need to reduce the rate.
Which is now set officially at
35%? At the top rate is 35%. It's sort of a superficial consensus between the parties, and there's not much real consensus beneath it. As Raquel points out, maybe the biggest problem from the get-go is that the business community is divided on this. And it's not clear to me that if you elect a Republican president and a Republican Congress tomorrow and hand them the keys to the kingdom and say, go ahead, reform the corporate tax system, that you're going to get reform of the corporate tax system, because it could very well happen is that the business community will line up on different sides and they'll fight it out and nothing will happen. I mean, that happens.
What are some of those sides? International versus domestic companies, manufacturers versus service companies?
Exactly. And there are certain kinds of companies that have a lot of operations overseas and manage to shift a lot of their profits to those operations overseas through accounting or whatever other mechanisms. They're doing pretty well a lot of the time. And they like this system. It works fairly well for them. Whereas people,
is it true that some of those companies pay 12% or less?
Oh, some pay much less, and it's primarily those companies, those sorts of industries in which they can easily shift their profits around. They have a lot of intellectual property, which is hard to pin down in one country or another, and they can move it to a low tax jurisdiction and do pretty well. Those companies are not interested in major reform of the system because the system works for them. Whereas there are other companies, particularly, say, domestic manufacturing companies, although they have their own incentives about the current system that they like, but they can't shift their profits around as easily. So everybody has some sort of dog in this fight, and it's hard to get them all on one side. It's not at all clear to me that corporate tax reform is on the horizon, despite the fact that everybody agrees it needs to happen.
I thought the fact that you were looking something up, Raquel, meant that you might have something you wanted to add.
Well, you know, when we look at like domestic manufacturing, like the single largest tax expenditure is related to accelerated depreciation, you know, and you have this group saying, you know, we love accelerated depreciation. I mean, when the economy turned down, we said 100% expensing. You buy it, you can deduct it right away, because we wanted people to buy this equipment and build plants and hire workers. Well, now you hear the administration saying, well, it's a big cost to us. We need to get rid of it. And so, you know, literally the same administration has two different takes on it, depending on whether they want to grow the economy today or solve the budget deficit in the future. And so it's very hard to talk about fairness when we have competing ideas about we've got to cure the deficit. But it's very easy to tip back into a recession. You know, Bernanke says there's not many Fed tools left. And we're going to be downgraded by Moody's if we don't solve this problem. So it's hard to do it all at once.
I realize we've been talking a lot about business taxes, and that certainly has been part of the political discussion lately. But in terms of individual taxes, is there much to be said about fairness or unfairness about which individuals pay what kind of taxes?
Well, you know, one thing that's happened a lot in this election is that a lot of liberals and Democrats like to talk about making the rich pay their fair share. And then the conservatives respond that that's a ridiculous statement. That's a ridiculous concept. I think that's a concept that actually needs to be on the table.
Well, let's put it on the table and talk about it more when we continue here on Virginia Insight with tax policy researchers Raquel Alexander and Joe Thorndike. If you have an idea about what would make taxes more fair for you or for the guy down the street, we've got a phone number for you, and we'll be sure that you hear about it in at least 1 minute. Former columnist for Bloomberg.com and current director of the Tax History Project, Joe Thorndike, is one of our guests. Sitting next to him, former tax consultant with the international auditing firm KPMG and current professor of accounting at Washington and Lee University, Raquel Alexander. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So to you who are listening, there have been a number of national surveys where a significant number of Americans seem to be saying something along the lines of, well, taxes for me, not really all that out of line, but that guy over there, he doesn't pay nearly enough. Does that perhaps describe your view? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. We are talking about making taxes more fair. Something to be said about this topic that you think we've so far missed. 888-967-2825. So mortgage deduction, home mortgage deduction, is that part of, you're nodding your head, Raquel, is that part of tax fairness?
Well, I think it's got to be part of the conversation. I mean, you heard the candidate Romney throw out this idea of a $25,000 cap, use however you want. Home mortgage deduction would be part of it. I mean, right now you can write off interest on up to $1 million loan for two houses. So, you know, it's really skewed towards high income individuals. Low income people don't itemize to begin with. And they certainly don't have $1 million mortgages. But when you think about who are the people that have them, oftentimes they're people that are on the coast. And so it's going to be a police officer and his wife who's a school teacher that have these expensive homes, but it's simply a function of where they live. So saying, you know, the rich are the people that use this home mortgage deduction the most, it's not necessarily true. You know, and so it makes it very complicated. So there's this idea of, okay, now we're going to index. Well, now if you live in a high cost state, you get a different deduction. And now our tax code gets more complex.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, economists generally hate this deduction. They just feel like this is a subsidy for homeowners and it's not clear.
And bankers?
Perhaps for bankers. But it's not clear why we would have that kind of a subsidy.
But you're the tax historian. I bet you know why or how we got to it.
Well, I'll tell you how we got to it, which was by accident, by and large. This is the oldest tax preference in our tax system, and it was not deliberate. Originally, you could deduct all the interest that you paid on anything. And that was built into the tax code starting in, you know, the 19-teens, the very early tax system. Gradually, it became harder and harder and eventually impossible to deduct just personal interest that you paid on you know, stuff, money you borrowed to buy stuff. But they carved it out such that money that interest that you paid for buying a house, you could deduct. But it was never a deliberate decision. It really sort of grew up, and as people started buying more houses, it became a bigger and bigger deal. But it wasn't until after World War II that it really started to matter. So, you know, we think of it as a birthright. And I guess at this point it is for almost everyone who's alive. But it wasn't like Congress had some original moment where they said, hey, we want to have people buying more houses, so let's create this deduction. That was an after-the-fact justification for why we have it.
And you don't see it all over the world. You know, they don't have it in the UK and, you know, many of our what we consider peer countries. So it's not like if we...
Do fewer people own homes in those countries? At least an argument, Joe, even if it was after the fact, that you create a more stable society by having more people own property, that people are more invested in their community if they own a home. And so if you give them a tax benefit to own a home, you're encouraging people to do something good for their society?
Right. So it's kind of that broken window theory that if you have people living in the homes, you know, they'll be taking care of it and the communities will maintain their value. You know, other research has shown that home ownership is like a shackle and people are staying in places where there are no jobs because that's where their home is. Mm-hmm. And so it's really reducing the mobility of a workforce that perhaps needs to leave a place like Detroit to find a job, but mm-hmm. that's where their homes are. So it's a double-edged sword, this home ownership.
My understanding is that the evidence is pretty ambiguous about whether it actually encourages home ownership in the first place, because among other things, it probably makes homes somewhat more expensive. which is not necessarily what we want either. And this argument about it being good for democracy or good for society, I will confess to having a sort of gut level positive reaction to that. That seems to make sense to me. But I mean, that doesn't mean it's true. And I think the evidence is also unclear that it's actually playing that role. So, you know, on
balance. But what about the second home?
Well, the second home, I think there's very little justification in terms of civics for that. And it doesn't have to be a home. You know, you can deduct the mortgage on your boat as long as it has a bathroom and a place to cook dinner, then it's deductible interest.
That's right.
Which is pretty ridiculous.
Right.
What else needs to be said about making taxes more fair?
Well, I think that, you know, that we need to think long and hard about the rates that we have and the fact that they're about to change at the end of the year with the fiscal cliff. We have lots of proposals that have been floated over the years in recent years for super taxes on super rich people. These are certainly, there's precedent for these in other countries. France is just about to impose a 75% tax on people making more than €1 million a year. And there are a lot of people in the U.S. who would like to see that sort of thing here as well. The whole Obama administration argument about, well, I won't raise taxes on anyone making less than $250,000 a year, but if you make more than that, then you're sort of fair game. I think this is the heart of the fairness question. It's not the only fairness question, but it's maybe the most obvious, especially because arguments about the top rate historically have always been the place where we chose to slug it out. And you know, there's a tendency, especially among Republicans, to hear this rhetoric on the left about, you know, rich people need to pay their fair share, and to get indignant about that and say, hey, that's ridiculous. That's just your opinion, and you're trying to impose that opinion on all the rest of us. So stop it. And I can see where they come to that position. But in reality, we have to have that argument. That's what the whole thing is about. Because if you don't change anything, well, that's a decision too. So, you know, it's true. It's just my opinion. If I come out and say, I think we need a new tax rate of 50% on the richest people, that is just my opinion. But tax rates are all about opinion. There's no scientific way to set the best tax rate or the right tax rate. Economists have some information to offer here about incentives and what might be more efficient. But ultimately, this is a value judgment. And the way we settle those value judgments is with a show of hands, basically. You know, we have to argue about it, and then we vote about it. And that is what it's all about.
Well, you know, one of the most regressive taxes is related to FICA, Social Security, and we're not even having that conversation. You know, the lower rate, the 2% off, is set to expire on December 31st, and no one's having that conversation. And it's a tax that hurts low-income workers the most.
I agree. I think that the payroll tax and what's about to happen to it and what has happened to it is one of the great unhad arguments. You know, yeah, you'd think that this would be a big deal right now because pretty much every working person in America pays this tax, regardless of how little they're making. For many, many Americans, it's the biggest tax they pay. And the most
burden. 47%.
That 47%. They're paying payroll taxes by and large, not every single one of them, but most of them.
And that's interesting because even though they don't technically pay the federal income tax, if they are paying what's commonly referred to as the payroll tax, mm-hmm. the deduction that goes to support Medicare and Social Security, they are supporting the U.S. government because that money goes to fund the national budget, doesn't it?
40% of our budget comes from those payroll taxes. 40%.
Now, to play devil's advocate, a lot of people will say, yeah, that's money they're paying in, and they're going to get paid out at the end, too. I mean, this is a contribution to a social program that they're going to benefit from at the end. There is some argument to be made that there's some legitimacy to that argument. But the reality is that we count on that information to actually fund the day-to-day operations of government. And Social Security has never been a deal in which we pay in all this money and it sits in a bank account. And at the end of the day, we get it all back again in monthly payments. It doesn't work like that. I mean, what really happens is that the government says, hey, we're going to pay a pension to people and we're going to pay for it with this payroll tax that you're all going to pay. And this current generation, you're going to pay for the people who are retired right now. And when you retire, the next generation is going to pay for you. So in reality, it's just funding government. And these people are definitely contributing to the cost of government.
But Raquel Alexander, when you call it a regressive tax, you're talking in fact about the idea that if somebody's making more than $110,000 a year, everything after that 110 currently doesn't have the Social Security and Medicare tax on it.
It has the Medicare tax. It doesn't have the Social Security tax on it. And so, you know, 4 years ago, we heard a lot of talk about this donut hole of like one way to raise revenue to make the tax system more progressive is to have that Social Security tax kick back in at 250. You heard other people propose $500,000, $1 million is when it should kick back in. Again, getting to Joe's idea of what are your values and maybe what is the average cost of living for your constituents. but, you know, we're just not having that conversation. We're going to lose the 4.2%. It's going to go back up to 6.2%. It's just not part of our national conversation. And a lot of the emphasis right now is on this fiscal cliff, but that isn't part of the discussion of the fiscal cliff.
You know, because what's happened here is that the Democrats who politically should love this tax cut because it's really their constituents who are benefiting the most, they are not interested in extending it. I think for some good reasons, there is an issue about, you know, it endangers Social Security as a program if you start messing around with the tax that supports it. I think if I were in the shoes of congressional Democrats, that would worry me some also. But the reality is we're still in a pretty precarious economy. This is a tax that falls most heavily on those least able to pay and those who are most likely to spend the extra money if they get it back in a tax cut. These poor people, when you give them a little extra money, will go out and buy things because they need those things. So this tax probably provides more stimulus than your average tax cut. It definitely helps those who need help the most. And we're really at a point where it's hard to imagine we're going to impose a 2% tax hike on every single working American. I mean, that's shocking to me that we aren't even talking about that.
It's because they don't have lobbyists. There's no FICA lobbyists. But there's a lobbyist to protect the special inventory method for Kentucky bourbon makers.
That's exactly right. And that's always been true, actually, that in many ways the broadest, most fundamental, most powerful issues of tax fairness have been orphaned, at least among professional lobbyists. And we have to rely on elected lawmakers to actually make the case themselves. You know, we need to rely on them to be our voices so that we can, you know, you get two kinds of voices in Washington, the ones you elect and the ones that you pay for. And I think that in this case, we need some people who have elected to office to really address it. If we come down and we say, look, it's dangerous for Social Security to have this tax cut, we need to get rid of it, so be it. But we need to actually talk about it more seriously before we let this happen, because I think this is a big tax hike, a very regressive tax hike at a time when we can least afford it.
Tax policy researchers Joe Thorndike and Raquel Alexander are our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone number is easy to remember as 888-WMRA Talk in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. It seems to me, Joe Thorndike, as the historian, maybe I should throw this question to you first, that earlier this year I heard as sort of a frequent Democratic Party talking point, hey, the last time the country was in super growth mode was back in the 1990s during the Clinton administration, where tax rates were considerably higher than they are now or they were during most of the Bush years. So we've had lower taxes. We haven't had growth. We had higher taxes before. We did have growth. Doesn't that defeat the argument that we need to lower taxes further to get more growth? What say ye?
Well, I think the lesson of history is that taxes are not the be-all and end-all of economic growth. Now, that being said, it's not that they're not important. And they are important, and they can encourage or discourage growth. But a lot of the time, other factors are more powerful. So you mentioned the 1990s, and that's a good example, and I'll come back to it. But, you know, another example that you hear tossed around a lot, especially among liberals, are the 1950s. Because this, if you're a liberal, is a great period to look at. You have a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower. For at least a couple of years, you have a fully Republican Congress. After the 1952 elections, the Republicans win both the House and the Senate. And at the same time, you have tax rates that top out over 90%. So we think our current rate at 35 sounds high, but the top rate through most of the 50s was either 91 or 92%. So you have these crazy high rates. You have Republicans in office, and you have growth, which is actually pretty good. It's around 4% a year through the 1950s. And so liberals today want to say, look, this just proves that high taxes and good growth are not inconsistent. True. So I would say, as a historian, that is true. But I also I think that there are a lot of other things that are going on at the same time. You know, so you're trying to make these historical comparisons to the 50s or the 90s. Well, in the 50s, it's true. We have really nice, reasonably brisk growth. And yet we're also the only country that's actually still standing in the 1950s. You know, all it took for us to be globally dominant was to reduce the rest of the world to rubble. Well, those countries are all trying to recover in the 50s. So, of course, the U.S. is going to be economically dominant and in a great trade position. Our competitiveness positioning was terrific then. That's what's really driving growth through most of the 50s. I think that's the same thing with the 90s. There are other non-tax related reasons why the country is doing so well, a lot of which have to do with the internet bubble that's going on in those years. But there's real growth. And I think taxes are not the key factor. That being said, nobody thinks that high rates, like 90%, are a good idea. And by and large, you want to have the lowest rates you can that are commensurate with still paying for the things that you need to pay for. I think our big problem right now is that we have, you know, nice, reasonably low rates, and we're not paying for the things that we need to pay for. And I'm not talking about the stimulus, the Obama stimulus, or anything like that. We have long-term budget problems, which are not going away, because we expect things like, in particular, Medicare to keep being there for us, but we haven't figured out how to pay for it. That is the huge issue going forward, is that we have no way to pay for health care in this country that's actually sensible.
888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. Stuart, thanks for calling in. I understand you've been driving somewhere along Interstate 81, but hopefully you are in a safe place right now. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
On my way to Florida and pulled over here off the road.
Good.
And I'm ready for a break, so I just wanted to suggest something. You know, in 99 years ago, the 16th Amendment was passed, giving Congress the authority to pass income tax. The first Senate, that amendment, gave them that authority. The second one said they didn't have to comply with apportionment rules elsewhere in the Constitution. And I'm at the end of my career. I'm a senior citizen, retired now. And I've watched this circus in Washington my entire career, and it's gone from two sentences to, I think we've got over 20,000 pages of tax code now. And I remember when Romney was quoted as saying 47% of these people that don't pay individual tax aren't going to vote for me, and I said, wow, that exhibits an astounding ignorance of this monster tax code that we've got, because there are a lot of people that are very wealthy that don't pay individual income tax. But never mind. I would like to suggest that all of the progressiveness that we've tried to help people either buy homes or survive on $25,000 a year has been backfired on us over the years, and I believe we should go to a straight, flat tax of all your gross income without any deductions whatsoever in the neighborhood of between 5 and 10%. That would include all tax entities. That would be individuals and corporations. So corporations would have no deductions either. It's just taken at the cash register, just like a sales tax. I think you might even call it a transaction tax. Because on a corporate level, a General Motors, which is gargantuan, that doesn't make any money, doesn't pay any tax. But the burden they represent in terms of service demands and stuff like that from the government is proportionate to their gross income.
Stuart, hold on for us, would you? We're going to hit the break, and I think Raquel has a gleam in her eyes that she wants to respond. Raquel Alexander says, as a small child, she was always fascinated by numbers and puzzles and how things did or did not fit together. So after taking her first class on tax policy in college, she was hooked. After several years in the private sector working as a tax consultant, today she teaches about policy as a professor of accounting at Washington and Lee University. Word is that when he was young, Joe Thorndike once told his parents he would never become a writer. He'd watched his father's struggles as a journalist, including his dad's time as the editor of Life magazine. Today, Dr. Thorndike serves as director of the Tax History Project, as a fellow of the George W. Bush Institute, and also, by the way, Joe's newest book, Their Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR, is coming out in a few weeks. What is your third, fourth book so far?
I think it's three.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've still got Stuart on the line, and I'm pretty sure, Raquel, that you had something you wanted to talk to him about.
Well, I think that what he's proposing, kind of a business transaction tax, is really a modern tax. It reflects society. So much of what we do escapes taxation because of where we locate it in a P.O. box in the Turks and Caicos, or because it's a certain type of product and we don't tax services, or for whatever reason. So many states, which are kind of our incubator of tax reform, are moving towards taxing transactions. And so Texas, which has got one of the largest economies, just implemented one of these taxes.
The state of Texas.
The state of Texas did. And we like these taxes as economists, kind of for policy reasons. They're simple to administer. They're easy to understand. They're convenient to pay, convenient to collect. Maybe you don't need the IRS. The problem is that they're regressive. And so when you look around the world, they're usually not a standalone tax. They're coupled with something else to make them less regressive. Other things that have been proposed would be kind of giving someone cash back. So the equivalent of the first $20,000 that you spend would be tax-free because we're going to give you a credit back as a way to make it more regressive. So people spending a little bit on shelter and food and clothing for their small families wouldn't be burdened as much.
So,
but
Stuart,
it's
I just
modern tax.
I want to make sure that you were talking not about a flat tax, but I guess you called it a transactional tax.
Well, actually, a flat tax is X number of dollars per citizen. A flat tax rate is what I was talking about, but since it applied to all gross income, anytime you make a transaction, you'd be paying that rate as the seller. If you go to an employer and sell your labor, you'd be paying that tax rate, 5 to 10%, whatever is necessary to fund the government. I think with a $20 trillion economy, a 5% tax would bring in about $1 trillion to the government.
You know, I think that this notion of a modern tax that Raquel threw out there, this is actually exactly right. And if we let me put my historian's hat back on here for a minute. If we look back at the history of U.S. taxes, what you see are that some taxes are popular and we use them a lot, and then after a while they become less popular and we use them less because they don't work as well anymore. Now go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think I understood that this tax is regressive. Any flat tax would be, to some extent, regressive. But one of the arguments against the modern tax code is that Warren Buffett pays less tax than his secretary. Okay, so we have 20,000 pages of tax code, and the wealthiest person in the country doesn't pay as much tax as most of the rest of us.
Well, and that's chiefly a result of the fact that we give a tax preference for capital gains income. And also for dividend income. That's why really rich people tend to pay lower taxes, because if you can get all the money that you take in every year characterized as capital gain rather than regular income, you're going to make out like a bandit relative to all the rest of us.
But in terms of fairness, does Stuart have a point that the kind of tax he's talking about, especially if you add on what Rebecca was mentioning, the policy proposals that would, in essence, give back to the poor what they'd spent on their first $20,000 worth of expenses?
Yeah, I mean that. I mean, I think that's a reasonable accommodation to progressive goals. I do also think that, you know, we should all maybe take a step back here, especially if you're a liberal or what we like. No, we're self-styled as progressives nowadays. Take a step back and say, what are we really after here? Am I after progressive taxes, or am I after a progressive government and a progressive society? Because if you look around the rest of the world, what you often find is that their tax systems are a lot less progressive than ours. But they also fund bigger, more progressive government. And so if you're a liberal and you think government should be doing more to take care of those who need the most help, who are least able to care for themselves, then it might be wise to think more about the spending side. So the bottom line being here, we can't really talk about fairness, about issues of distributional fairness, unless we talk about both the taxing and the spending side. Because if you use a regressive tax to fund a really progressive spending program, on balance, that can be very progressive. So I what I would do is I would caution liberals to say, don't make progressive taxes the be-all and end-all of your agenda. You really want to look at it more broadly. And so you can use something like a modern tax, which might be more easily collectible, more economically efficient. Use it to fund progressive programs, and you come out as a winner if you're a progressive, if you're a liberal. That's something that the rest of the world learned a long time ago, but the U.S., I think, is still figuring out.
Stuart, thanks so much for your call. Next to Nelson County, Al, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question and comment, please, either for Raquel Alexander or Joe Thorndike.
Okay. Well, I want to also just point out that I don't think Warren Buffett pays less than his secretary. He pays at a rate less than his secretary. But I'm sure he pays a whole lot more taxes than she does. But what I wanted to really talk about was the fact that when I was in graduate school studying economics, I remember learning something about the balanced budget impact. And the point was that a dollar spent by the government had the same economic impact on the economy as a dollar spent by me if I'm in the CVS drugstore or anywhere else. And we are a nation desperately needing new infrastructure, desperately needing new investment in education and all the things that make us a modern competitive nation. Yet we're afraid to tax ourselves for that, fear that we'll starve the private sector. With interest rates at where they are, obviously the private sector isn't being forced out of the market by the government. I just wonder whether your panelists would comment on that.
Yeah, so I agree. I think the tax system that we have now and how we change it, if we can change it, affects the type of jobs that we're going to have in this country in the future. And I think we need to think long and hard about what that is and what's going to set us up and our children and our grandchildren up to succeed in the future. And definitely spending on infrastructure has payoffs. Spending on education has payoffs. And the question is, when people propose to reduce the rates, what are they going to do, right? Are they going to cut some program? Are they cutting Head Start? Are they cutting farm subsidies?
Well, there are some who seem to still be operating on the theory that the lower you make the rates, the more revenue that you raise, because lower rates generate more economic activity. Everybody gets wealthier, including the government.
In its strongest form, like the one you really just presented there, That's just crazy talk. I hate to say it, but it is. Tax cuts do not pay for themselves. Only the outliers among economists would even try to make that argument. I think the respectable conservative argument to make is that I'm going to cut rates. You lefty liberal think that this is going to cost us $1 trillion, but I'm telling you that we're going to grow enough that it's only going to cost us $500 billion. So growth can reduce the cost of a tax cut. It does not eliminate it. And this is an important distinction to make, because there is no such thing as a tax cut that raises money. It's never been true. As a general rule, certainly at the federal level, I think it's almost invariably true. They lose money. Now, it might be okay. We might want to lose that money. It might do other good things for us, but don't kid yourself. You cut taxes, it's going to cost you money.
And you often see politicians pointing to like state governments, like, look what they did in Louisiana. They cut rates, they gave businesses incentive, all this came over. But it's really just moving the deck chairs around. You know, businesses went from Oklahoma and Texas to Louisiana. Well, we're dealing at a national level here, right? We can't use those same types of incentives that we see working sort of well at the state level. So it's just very difficult to quantify.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I think rate cuts are great. You know, on balance, we'd rather that the rates were lower rather than higher. But we do need to pay attention to how much money we're bringing in, because the bigger long-term threat right now to this country is not high tax rates. It's unchecked debt. And again, I am not talking about the debt that's come about as a result of our current recession and the stimulus that's come around afterwards. This is long-term debt about entitlements, and solving that problem is our most important challenge on the economic front. Cutting taxes doesn't solve that problem.
Well, you know, we had 19% of our debt held by foreign countries in the 90s. We are over 48% now, mainly held by Japan and China. It's a problem.
Al, thank you so much for calling. Next to Harrisonburg, Kirk, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Joe Thorndike and or Raquel Alexander, please. Kirk, you still with us?
Hi. I was wondering about the transaction tax you were talking about a little earlier. How similar is that to the fair tax proposal, which has been is a bill before both the House and Senate?
Well, the fair tax takes a number of forms depending on whose bill it is. In general, it's this flat rate. Everyone pays the same rate. Most of the times I've seen it where the investment income has been excluded. So it wouldn't tax interest income, dividends, capital gains. That's kind of how I've seen it mm-hmm. played out.
It tends to come with a big, they call it a prebate, mm-hmm. which is the kind of rebate you were talking about, such that the initial X number of dollars that you spend would be essentially tax-free. That's to try to make it more progressive. But I think people would be pretty shocked at how a retail sales tax worked if it were the only source of revenue for the federal government. I mean, we'd be taxing all sorts of things that people are not used to paying tax on.
Rent. You know, we see rent. I've seen it proposed where when you buy a house, you have to pay the tax on the purchase price of the house.
Only if it's a new house. If you bought a used house, right. One that somebody else owned, you wouldn't pay any tax. Now, I just think that on the ground, and this is liable to really irritate a lot of your callers because the fair tax has a lot of fans who really like it. But I think that it's just not a plausible tax in most of its varieties. It's too big. When you make it the only source of federal revenue, it ends up having a pretty high rate, and that creates lots of incentives for evasion. I just think people are not going to do it.
Well, and all the talk now is about lowering rates. You know, when this was getting more traction, maybe 6 years ago, they were saying 17 to 20%. The economists say it's going to be at least 30% to raise enough revenue. And then you really have people buying stuff out of the back of pickup trucks.
Kirk, thanks for the important clarification that you provoked. We're running short on time, so let's go right next to Jonathan, who's also calling from Harrisonburg. Jonathan, you're on Virginia Insight.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment about entitlements, and I see them all the time in even saddening ways. I'm a counselor, and I see students, many of my students get government handouts or have parents who get government handouts, and I think some of the intentions are good, but I have students who tell me they don't need to do good in school because they can just get a government check from their parents. And, in fact, some of them already get government checks because of just a mental health disorder, which I think is fine for adults. But for kids who don't need to achieve an income anyway, their parents should be providing for them, or the government should be giving money to the parents for housing, not the kid.
Well, I think that, that is that's the spending side of the equation, and that's a legitimate argument to have. What sorts of entitlements do we want, and who should they be going to? So, you might have disability benefits that go to people. I think that's what the caller was suggesting right there. But those are really not the most expensive benefits that we have out there. Our most expensive, by far, the biggest hole in the budget, by far, is not Social Security, either for old people or for the disabled. We have a modest problem in funding Social Security, but it's pretty readily solvable. Medicare and Medicaid, we have no plan in place and no credible plans out there by either party on how we're actually going to pay for this. We say, we're going to bend the cost curve, which is great. I'm all for bending the cost curve, but nobody actually knows how that's going to happen. So I think that we can argue about certain kinds of entitlements, but it's fair to say, I think if you look at the numbers, Americans think that Medicare is a good thing and that they deserve it when they get old. Keep your hands off my Medicare, or whatever that line was from a few years ago. And so we want it, but we're not paying for it.
Well, I think the other important piece that he's talking about is how we really moved social programs to the tax code. Like, if you want to encourage low-income housing, we'll give them a credit. You want to encourage charitable giving, give them a deduction. You want teachers to buy supplies, give them a deduction. And so you've got the IRS administering social and economic development programs. And is that really what we want them to do? And are they the most qualified? And, you've got IRS agents learning about how the railroads work because they're administrating those programs.
And it causes...
Jonathan, thank you so much for your call. We're so short on time. I really wish Jonathan's call had come in almost an hour ago because he touches on something that seems to be an essential part of political thinking for a certain segment of the population in the U.S., and that is that social programs cause more problems than they solve. So why are we wasting our tax dollars on them? Obviously, we don't have, in the last minute, much time to get into all this, but I am curious, Raquel, since you talk some about how much more money is spent on social programs in other countries in the world where overall tax rates are so much higher, what's different there? Do people just have a different attitude towards helping out the poor and the disadvantaged? Or do they also worry a great deal about money being wasted and encouraging bad behavior through government social programs?
I think it's probably a difference of the American psyche. You know, we're a little bit more of striking out on our own, and we're going to do this on our own and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and less socialist in that thinking. However, I will say that some of the former Eastern Bloc countries use a flat tax. Mm-hmm. So when they talk about, oh, we're looking like France, we're socialist, these flat tax, fair tax people look strikingly like the communist countries. Mm-hmm.
You know, and also a lot of the difference between the U.S. and other countries in terms of social spending comes down to, again, not to just become like a one-trick pony here, but it's healthcare again. They pay for healthcare through their government. We choose not to do that. Mm-hmm. That's about one of the biggest differences.
Well, our biggest expenditure is the healthcare exclusion. That's the biggest one.
So many things I want to ask, but we're out of time. Our guests have been corporate tax policy researcher and professor of accounting at Washington and Lee University, Raquel Alexander, plus tax policy historian, fellow at the George W. Bush Institute, and director of the Tax History Project, Joe Thorndike. Raquel, Joe, thank you both for making time for us.
Thanks.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about both of our guests and their work they're doing, and Joe's latest book. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.